Hi, I'm Michael Overholt, and this is Ponticuli Episode 15. Last week, we held the College of Charleston's TLTCon 2020. It was our first ever virtual conference because we didn't have a choice, thank you COVID-19. But it was a great success in spite of a breakout room fiasco in the opening session. Thank you, Zoom security updates. And it turned out to be an international virtual conference, with folks attending from as far away as India, Ireland, and Japan. Key to its success was the leadership of the one and only Mendy Benini, collaborative work of the TLT staff, and a robust repertoire of resilient presenters. In the planning process, however, I had the special privilege of corresponding with our keynote speaker, James M. Lang, a professor of English and the director of the DeMoor Center for Teaching Excellence at Assumption University. His first lecture focused on his 2016 publication, Small Teaching, and his second on his 2013 publication, Cheating Lessons. After the conference had ended, I had this added pleasure of talking with him about navigating the worlds of writing, teaching, and online course design. I hope you enjoy listening. Really enjoyed having you last week at TLTCon, and I thought I'd ask a couple of questions, some about TLTCon, but also some about your writing, maybe some of the social issues that are going on now that a lot of universities have moved to an online environment. And so let's just begin with the writing question I had. You've written several books in the past couple of years, namely Cheating Lessons and Small Teaching, and you have another one coming out this year called Distracted: Why Students Can't Focus and What You Can Do About It. Why do you write? What drives you?
So there's a couple drivers here. The first is that in general I like to write. So my first love has always been writing, and that's why I'm an English professor and came up through that and teach courses in writing. And so, you know, I would say that has, if I wasn't writing about teaching, I'd be writing about something else. But I do write about teaching because I also find the challenge of teaching to be a kind of endlessly interesting and challenging one. You can always do better. This context is always changing, and there are always new problems and challenges that arise in education. So if you look at the two books that you mentioned in the introduction, Cheating Lessons and Distracted, those books are actually kind of attempts to solve problems that were vexing to me. So that's one of the things that I often do in writing, is try and figure out what I think about it. When I've come across a problem in my own teaching, or I see people having problems in their teaching, and I kind of want to say, all right, well, what are we supposed to do about this? And then it leads me to do a little looking things up and talking to people and researching. And then eventually it's through the writing that I try to figure out what I can do about it. And then, you know, that final step of sort of recommending it to other people is what helps you get it out into the world. But that's kind of those twin drivers are, first of all, I do love to write, and I kind of, you know, I write all the time and, journals and shorter works and longer works, but then also because I'm in the classroom and it's like I said, it's an interesting and challenging situation. I find myself just sort of continually drawn to write about that.
You noted in one of your keynote addresses last week, and I think it was the second one, that we were seeing two sides of your teaching recommendations. Large-scale redesigning of courses and then small incremental changes. You then noted that small teaching was written because you realized a lot of what you were proposing were really big undertakings, and that realization led to small teaching. So can you elaborate on how that realization came about? Did you notice substantial pushback from teachers who felt overwhelmed by the amount of work that large-scale renovations required?
Not really. It was more that people just listened and said, yeah, that's really interesting, and then didn't make the changes. And there was a member in particular on my own campus, and she kept coming to see me and saying, you know, I want to make changes. I'd like to improve my teaching. Things aren't working as well as I would like. And I would make the kinds of recommendations that I made, the kind of larger scale recommendations that emerged from Cheating Lessons. And she just would come back the next time and say, yeah, I wasn't able to do that. I just, you know, I didn't have the time or energy to do that. And this happened several times with her. And so this was part of the thing that kind of made me notice it. The other thing was, after Cheating Lessons came out, I got invited to do a lot of keynotes and workshops and stuff. on other campuses. And again, I would find that people were really interested in reading and hearing the research about cheating and like how it happens and why it happens. And then, you know, these would often be interactive sessions. And then when we would switch to the recommendations part, people would be kind of like, yeah, okay, I see the logic behind that. But I didn't get a strong sense that people were excited about the recommendations, that they were going to go put them into practice. So that was kind of just this growing sense that, and you know, you like I was doing keynotes for you, you know, I come in as an outsider and I do something relatively short with your faculty. But I want it to be worthwhile for people and I want it to have the experience be something that makes a potential difference to them. So that's when I kind of started to try to think about what really would be the most helpful thing. If you come into another campus and have 2 hours to spend with people, you know, what can you give them that's really going to be the most helpful? As I was, you know, trying to figure that out, I also had started to put some smaller recommendations in the talk. And I noticed that that's when people got interested. People got kind of excited to see, oh, you know, I could try, that's something I could actually try tomorrow. It wouldn't require that much change in my teaching or that much, you know, significant new work. And so that just kind of gradually, all these things kind of just gradually led to the idea of trying to identify things that would be most helpful to people. So part of it was kind of being out speaking at other campuses and trying to want it to be as helpful as possible. And the other part of it was just seeing the way that my own faculty on my own campus reacted to the kinds of recommendations that I was offering.
Yeah, it was a nice hook with the baseball analogy. I really enjoyed right. that one. Yeah.
Actually, someone gave me another analogy once, which I really liked too. And it was actually after the book came out, but said, you know, you could think about evolution in a similar way, right? Like evolution has made, you know, produced this incredible variety, these massive transformations over time, but it happens through very small changes happening, you know, little by little in all these different ways. And I like that way of thinking about it as well, because you can lead to you can create transformative change through small efforts. It just takes time.
A social issue that I'm curious about. There have been a lot of steps taken to help underprivileged students cope with the expenses of higher education. Do you feel like any of your books significantly addresses this issue or could be used by teachers who are wanting to make higher ed more affordable for underprivileged or first-generation college students?
I'm not sure about affordability, but it's definitely the case that the kind of small engagement strategies that I recommend are ones which are designed to draw in many of the students who wouldn't normally be drawn into education. So I do hope that the particularly the engagement strategies that you find in small teaching are ones that can help reach as many learners as possible, including those learners that don't, that might face particular challenges, first generation students, for example, who might not feel as welcomed or as comfortable participating in class. A lot of the changes in small teaching that I recommend are active engagement strategies that get everyone involved and that can help build and support that sense of community. There's actually a second edition of Small Teaching coming out in 2021, and there's actually going to be a completely new chapter on supporting students, and that will include strategies about how to build community, about how to make learners feel welcome. And so I hope that that will help. That's an increasing interest, I think, of people in higher education right now. And I'd like to pull some of that research together and see what kinds of small changes can be recommended. In fact, I talked about one of them in the keynote, the values affirmation. To me, that's a great example of a small thing that you can do to help support students.
Person wanting to create a fully online course from one that they had taught previously, what are the essentials, in your opinion, for making an engaging online course? And I'm speaking of, you know, beyond using an LMS for like a grade book or just posting documents.
So I think the first thing I would say is obviously you have to work a little bit harder to create that sense of community and presence. So anything you can do in order to help the class feel like it's a community of learners, something that happens a little bit more easily when you've got a bunch of people sitting in the room with you, although it doesn't happen automatically. So we have to do work on that in both cases, but I think it's more challenging in the online community. So the first thing is to try and identify strategies that help people feel welcome. How do you reach out? How can you create sort of welcome activities or videos and get people engaging with one another? The second thing I would say is structure. So there's a great article by Viji Sathy and Kelly Hogan in the Chronicle of Higher Education about inclusive teaching. And they make a distinction between low structure and high structure. High structure is where there's a lot of touch points between the students and the faculty and between the students themselves that kind of help students stay on track, show them, you know, what they need to do in order to succeed. And I think that that is really important in online teaching, because otherwise, you know, you can sort of give an assignment and then just sort of send students away and have them fend for themselves. And I think that's especially in relationship to what we were just talking about, that's going to be especially difficult for students who might not, who face challenges in their learning and in their access to education. So those students in particular need that high structure. But I think actually everybody really benefits from it in an online environment. So I would say that high structure kind of, and you can look at Sathy and Hogan's article for a good description of what some of those high structure techniques look like. I think those are the two things that's kind of spring to my mind immediately. Maybe the one other thing would be to just provide multiple methods of engagement. So again, this is true in face-to-face teaching. You want to have students, you know, listening to lectures, but also engaging in discussions, doing other kinds of activities, writing, thinking, speaking, etc. The more that we do, the better it is for our learning. And so the same should be true of an online class. It maybe should not just be all text-based, where it's just, read these materials and post your discussion responses. They should have the opportunity to see some videos, to read some things, to look at some infographics, and then they should be able to respond by making short videos or by writing. They should be able to speak to the teacher, but also to their peers. So you want to think about like multiple strategies of engagement rather than just being at kind of like one pathway there and back between the faculty members and the students. So I think those would be the three biggest things that I would emphasize to people.
I really appreciate the structure note. I think that's one of the first things that becomes that's realized when you think of maybe a class that you entered and you're like, you know, I'm going to just kind of wing it. You can't ever really wing it.
Right. That's a great point. Absolutely. That is a great point. You can do that in a face-to-face class, right? You can come in and see, you know, I've got some notes here and I'm just going to kind of go and we'll see where the discussion goes, but that's much less likely to work in an online class. And I just got my student evaluations. And one of the things I saw over and over, and I'm a very structured, organized person in general, so like this comes pretty naturally to me. And so my class was pretty structured. You know, we did the same thing, you know, we had the same routines and every, you know, there was something every day. And I heard the evaluations were commented on that. Like, you know, it really was helpful to have things on a very set path that I could follow. And that wasn't happening in a lot of my other classes. So that convinced me that this is an important value.
This podcast is a production of the Teaching and Learning team at the College of Charleston. I'm Michael Overholt, and I directed and produced this episode. Thank you, Professor Lang, for talking with me, and thank you to all who presented and attended TLTCon 2020. Farewell, friends.